Blue Mars, Cassette 9. But as she continued to ascend, day after day, up and up beyond all imagining, the snow patches became thinner, less frequent. Eventually, she was 20 kilometers above the datum, 21 above sea level, nearly 70,000 feet above the ice, more than twice as high as Everest was above Earth's oceans. And still the cone of the volcano rose above her, a full 7,000 meters more, right up into the darkening sky, right up into space. Far below scrolled a smooth, flat layer of cloud obscuring Tharsis, as if the white sea were chasing her up the slope. Up at this level there were no clouds, at least on this day. Sometimes thunderheads would tower up beside the mountain. Other days cirrus clouds could be seen overhead, slashing the sky with a dozen thin sickles. Today the sky above was a clear purple indigo suffused with black, pricked with a few daytime stars at the zenith, Orion standing faint and alone. Out to the east of the volcano's summit streamed a thin cloud, a peak banner, so faint she could see the dark sky through it. There wasn't much moisture up here, nor much atmosphere either. There would always be a tenfold difference between the air pressure at sea level and up here on the big volcanoes. Pressure up here must therefore be about 35 millibars, very little more than what had existed when they had arrived. Nevertheless, she spotted tiny flecks of lichen in hollows on the tops of rocks, in pits that caught some snow and then a lot of sun. They were almost too small to see. Lichen. A symbiotic team of algae and fungus working together to survive, even in 30 millibars. It was hard to believe what life would endure. So strange. So strange, in fact, that she suited up and went out to look at them. Up here, one had to employ all the old careful habits. Secure walker, locked doors, out into the bright glare of low space. The rocks that harbored the lichen were the kind of flat sun porches on which marmots would have sunbathed if they could have lived so high. Instead, only little pinheads of yellow-green or battleship gray. Flake lichen, the wrist pad guide said. Bits of it torn away in storms, blown up here, falling on rocks, sticking like little vegetable limpets. The kind of thing only Hiroko could explain. Living things. Michelle had said that she loved stones and not men because she had been mistreated, her mind damaged. Hippocampus significantly smaller, strong startle reaction, a tendency toward dissociation. And so she had found a man as much like a stone as she could. Michelle, too, had loved that quality in Simon, he told her. Such a relief in the Underhill years to have even won such charge. A man you could trust, quiet and solid, that you could heft in your hand and feel the weight of. But Simon wasn't the only one in the world like that, Michelle had pointed out. That quality rested in the others as well, intermixed and less pure, but still there. Why could she not love that quality of obdurate endurance in other people, in every living thing? They were only trying to exist. Like any rock or planet. There was a mineral stubbornness in all of them. Wind keened past her helmet and over the shards of lava, humming in her air hose, drowning out the sound of her breath. The sky more black than indigo here, except low on the horizon where it was a hazy purple violet topped by a band of clear dark blue. Oh, who could believe it would ever change? Up here on the slope of Ascrius Mons, why hadn't they settled up here to remind themselves of what they had come to, of what they had been given by Mars, and then so profligately thrown away? Back to the rover. She continued on up. She was above silver cirrus clouds just west of the volcano's diaphanous summit banner, in the lee of the jet stream. To ascend was to travel into the past, above all lichen and bacteria, though she had no doubt they were still there, hiding inside the first layers of the rock. Chasmoendolithic life, like the mythic little red people. The microscopic gods who had spoken to John Boone, their own local Hesiod. So people said. Life everywhere. The world was turning green. But if you couldn't see the greenness, if it made no difference to the land, surely it was welcome to the task? Living creatures. Michelle had said to her, "You love stones because of the stony quality that life has. It all comes back to life." Simon, Peter, on this rock I will build my church. Why could she not love that stony quality in everything? The rover rolled up the last concentric terraces of lava, working less strenuously now as it curved over the asymptotic flattening of the broad circular rim, only slightly uphill and less so every meter, and then onto the rim itself, then to the inner edge of the rim. Overlooking the caldera, she got out of the car, her thoughts flicking about like skuas. Ascrius's nested caldera complex consisted of 8 overlapping craters, the newer ones collapsing down across the circumferences of the older ones. The largest and youngest caldera lay out near the center of the complex, and the older, higher-floored calderas embayed its circumference like the petals of a flower design. Each caldera floor was at a slightly different elevation and marked by a pattern of circular fractures. Walking along the rim changed perspective so that distances shifted, and the floor's heights seemed to change as if they were floating in a dream. Taken all in all, a beautiful thing to witness, and 80 kilometers across. Like a lesson in volcano throat mechanics, eruptions down on the outer flanks of the volcano had emptied the magma from the active throat of the volcano, and so the caldera floor had slumped, thus all the circular shapes as the active throat moved around over the eons. Arcing cliffs. Few places on Mars exhibited such vertical slopes. They were almost true verticals. Basalt ring worlds. It should have been a climber's mecca, but as far as she knew, it wasn't. Someday they would come. The complexity of Ascrius was so unlike the single great hole of Pavonis. Why had Pavonis's caldera collapsed in the same circumference every time? Could its last drop have erased and leveled all the other rings? Had its magma chamber been smaller or vented to the sides less? Had Ascrius's throat wandered more? She picked up loose rocks on the rim's edge, stared at them. Lava bombs, late meteor ejecta, ventifacts in the ceaseless winds. These were all questions that could still be studied. Nothing they did would ever disturb the volcanology up here, not enough to impede the study. Indeed, the Journal of Areological Studies published many articles on these topics, as she had seen and still occasionally saw. It was as Michelle had said to her, the high places would look like this forever. Climbing the great slopes would be like travel into the pre-human past, into pure areology. Into the areophany itself, perhaps, with Hiroko or not, with the lichen or not. People had talked of securing a dome or tent over these calderas to keep them completely sterile, but that would only make them zoos, wilderness parks, garden spaces with their walls and their roofs, empty greenhouses. No. She straightened up, looked out over the vast round landscape held up and offering itself to space. To the chasmoendolithic life that might be struggling up here, she waved a hand. Live, thing. She said the word and it sounded odd. Live. Mars forever, stony in the sunlight. But then she glimpsed the white bear in the corner of her eye, slipping behind a jagged rim boulder. She jumped. Nothing there. She returned to the rover, feeling that she needed its protection. She climbed inside, but then, all afternoon on the screen of the rover's AI, the vague, spectacled eyes seemed to be looking out at her, about to call any second. A kind bear of a man, though he would eat her if he could catch her. If he could catch her, but then none of them could catch her. She could hide in these high rock fastnesses forever. Free she was, and free she would be, to be or not to be if she chose that, for as long as this rock held. But there again, right at the locked door, that white flash in the corner of her eye. Ah, so hard. Part 7. Making Things Work. An ice-choked sea now covered much of the north. Vastitas Borealis had lain a kilometer or two below the datum, in some places 3. Now, with sea level stabilizing at the -1 contour, most of it was underwater. If an ocean of similar shape had existed on Earth, it would have been a bigger Arctic Ocean, covering most of Russia, Canada, Alaska, Greenland, and Scandinavia, and then making 2 deeper incursions farther south, narrow seas that extended all the way to the equator. On Earth, these would have made for a narrow North Atlantic and a North Pacific occupied in its center by a big squarish island. This Oceanus Borealis was dotted by several large icy islands and a long low peninsula that broke its circumnavigation of the globe, connecting the mainland north of Syrtis with the tail of a polar island. The North Pole was actually on the ice of Olympia Gulf, some kilometers offshore from this polar island. And that was it. On Mars there would be no equivalent of the South Pacific or the South Atlantic or the Indian Ocean or the Antarctic Ocean. In its south there was only desert except for the Hellas Sea, a circular body of water about the size of the Caribbean. So while ocean covered 70% of the Earth, it covered about 25% of Mars. In the year 2130, most of Oceanus Borealis was covered by ice. There were large pods of liquid water under the surface, however, and in the summer, melt lakes scattered on top of the surface. There were also many polynyas, leads, and cracks. Because most of the water had been pumped or otherwise driven out of the permafrost, it had deep groundwater's purity, meaning it was nearly distilled. The Borealis was a freshwater ocean. It was expected to become salty fairly soon, however, as rivers ran through the very salty regolith and carried their loads into the sea, then evaporated, precipitated, and repeated the process, moving salts from the regolith into the water until a balance was reached, a process which had the oceanographers transfixed with interest for the degree of saltiness of Earth's oceans, stable for many millions of years, was not well understood. The coastlines were wild. The polar island, formerly nameless, was called variously the Polar Peninsula, or the Polar Island, or the Seahorse, for its shape on maps. In actuality, its coastline was still overrun in many places by the ice of the old polar cap, and everywhere it was blanketed by snow, blown into patterns of giant sastrugi. This corrugated white surface extended out over the sea for many kilometers until underwater currents fractured it, and one came on a coastline of leads and pressure ridges and the chaotic edges of big tabular bergs, as well as larger and larger stretches of open water. Several large volcanic or meteoric islands rose up out of the shatter of this ice coast, including a few pedestal craters sticking up out of the whiteness like great black tabular bergs. The southern shores of the Borealis were much more exposed and various. Where the ice lapped against the foot of the great escarpment, there were several Mensi and Collies regions that had become offshore archipelagos, and these, as well as the mainland coastline proper, sported many beetling sea cliffs, bluffs, crater bays, fossa fjords, and long stretches of low, smooth strand. The water in the two big southern gulfs was extensively melted below the surface, and in the summers, on the surface as well. Crissy Gulf had perhaps the most dramatic coastline of all. 8 big outbreak channels dropping into Crissy had partly filled with ice, and as it melted, they were becoming steep-sided fjords. At the southern end of the gulf, 4 of these fjords braided, weaving together several big cliff-walled islands to make the most spectacular seascapes of all. Over all this water, great flocks of birds flew daily. Clouds bloomed in the air and rushed off on the wind, dappling the white and red with their shadows. Icebergs floated across the melted seas and crashed against the shore. Storms dropped off the great escarpment with terrifying force, dashing hail and lightning onto the rock. There were now approximately 40,000 kilometers of coastline on Mars. And in the rapid freeze and thaw of the days and the seasons, under the brush of the constant wind, every part of it was coming alive. When the Congress ended, Nadia made plans to get off Pavonis Mons immediately. She was sick of the bickering in the warehouse, of arguments, of politics, sick of violence and the threat of violence. Sick of revolution, sabotage, the Constitution, the elevator, Earth, and the threat of war. Earth and death, that was Pavonis Mons. Peacock Mountain, with all the peacocks preening and strutting and crying, me, me, me. It was the last place on Mars Nadia wanted to be. She wanted to get off the mountain and breathe the open air. She wanted to work on tangible things. She wanted to build with her 9 fingers and her back and her mind. Build anything and everything, not just structures, although those would be wonderful, of course, but also things like air or dirt, parts of a construction project new to her, which was simply terraforming itself. Ever since her first walk in the open air down at Dumartha Ray Crater, free of everything but a little CO2 filter mask, Sax's obsession had finally made sense to her. She was ready to join him and the rest of them in that project, and more than ever now, as the removal of the orbiting mirrors had kicked off a long winter and threatened a full ice age. Build air, build dirt, move water, introduce plants and animals. All that kind of work sounded fascinating to her now. And of course, the more conventional construction projects beckoned as well. When the new North Sea melted and its shoreline stabilized, there would be harbor towns to be inlaid everywhere, scores of them, no doubt, each with jetties and seafronts, channels, wharves, and docks, and the towns behind them rising into the hills. At the higher altitudes, there would be more tent towns to be erected and covered canyons. There was even talk of covering some of the big calderas, and of running cable cars between the 3 Prince volcanoes, or bridging the narrows south of Elysium. There was talk of inhabiting the polar island continent. There were new concepts in biohousing, plans to grow homes and buildings directly out of engineered trees, as Hiroko has used bamboo, but on a bigger scale. Yes, a builder ready to learn some of the latest techniques had 1,000 years of lovely projects ahead of her. It was a dream come true. Then a small group came to her and said they were exploring possibilities for the first executive council of the new global government. Nadia stared at them. She could see their import like a big slow-moving trap. And she tried her best to run out of it before it snapped shut. There are lots of possibilities, she said. About 10 times more good people than council positions. Yes, they said, looking thoughtful. But we were wondering if you had ever thought about it. No, she said. Art was grinning, and seeing that she began to get worried. "I plan to build things," she said firmly.
"You could do that, too," Art said. "The council is a part-time job."
"The hell it is."
"No, really."
It was true that the concept of citizen government was written everywhere into the new constitution, from the global legislature to the courts to the tents. People would presumably do a good deal of this work part-time. Nadia was quite sure, however, that the executive council was not going to be in that category. "Don't executive council members have to be elected out of the legislature?" she asked. "Elected by the legislature," they told her happily. "Usually fellow legislators would be elected, but not necessarily." "Well, there's a mistake in the Constitution for you," Nadia said. "Good thing that you caught it so soon. Restrict it to elected legislators, and you'll cut your pool way down."
"Way down."
"And still have lots of good people," she backpedaled. But they were persistent. They kept coming back in different combinations, and Nadia kept running toward that narrowing gap between the teeth of the trap. In the end, they begged, a whole little delegation of them. This was the crucial time for the new government. They needed an executive council trusted by all. It would be the one to get things started, etc., etc. The Senate had been elected. The Duma had been drafted. Now the two houses were electing the 7 executive council members. People mentioned as candidates included Mikhail, Zake, Peter, Marina, Etzu, Nano, Ariadne, Marion, Irishka, Antar, Rashid, Jackie, Charlotte, the 4 ambassadors to Earth, and several others Nadia had first met in the warehouse. "Lots of good people," Nadia reminded them. This was the polycephalous revolution. But people were uneasy at the list, they told Nadia repeatedly. They had become used to her providing a balanced center, both during the Congress and during the revolution, and before that at Dorsa Brevia, and for that matter, throughout the underground years and right back to the beginning. People wanted her on the council as a moderating influence, a calm head, a neutral party, etc., etc. "Get out," she said, suddenly angry, though she didn't know why. They were concerned to see her anger, upset by it. "I'll think about it," she said as she shooed them out to keep them moving. Eventually, only Charlotte and Art were left, looking serious, looking as if they hadn't conspired to bring all this about.
"They seem to want you on the executive council," Art said.
"Oh, shut up."
"But they do. They want someone they can trust."
"They want someone they're not afraid of, you mean. They want an old babushka who won't try to do anything so they can keep their opponents off the council and pursue their own agendas." Art frowned. He hadn't considered this. He was too naive.
"You know, a constitution is kind of like a blueprint," Charlotte said thoughtfully.
"Getting a real working government out of it is the true act of construction."
"Out!" Nadia said.
But in the end, she agreed to stand. They were relentless. There were a surprisingly large number of them, and they wouldn't give up. She didn't want to seem like a shirker, and so she let the trap close down on her leg. The legislatures met, the ballots were cast. Nadia was elected one of the 7, along with Zake, Ariadne, Marion, Peter, Mikhail, and Jackie. That same day, Irishko was elected the first Chief Justice of the Global Environmental Court, a real coup for her personally and the Reds generally. This was part of the grand gesture Art had brokered at the Congress's end to gain the Red support. About half the new justices were Reds of one shade or another, making for a gesture just a bit too grand, in Nadia's opinion. Immediately after these elections, another delegation came to her, led this time by her fellow counselors.
She had gotten the highest ballot total in the two houses, they told her, and so the others wanted to elect her president of the council. Oh, no, she said. They nodded gravely. The president was just another member of the council, they told her, one among equals. A ceremonial position only. This arm of the government was modeled on Switzerland's, and the Swiss didn't usually even know who their president was, and so on. Though, of course, they would need her permission, Jackie's eyes glittered slightly at this, her acceptance of the post. Out, she said. After they had left, Nadia sat slumped in her chair, feeling stunned. You're the only one on Mars that everyone trusts, Art said gently. He shrugged as if to say he hadn't been involved, which she knew was a lie. What can you do? He said, rolling his eyes with a child's exaggerated theatricality. Give it 3 years and then things will be on track and you can say you did your part and retire. Besides, the first president of Mars, how could you resist? Easy. Art waited. Nadia glared at him. Finally, he said, but you'll do it anyway, right? You'll help me? Oh, yes. He put a hand on her clenched fist. All you want. I mean, I'm at your disposal. Is that an official Praxis position? Why, yes, I'm sure it could be. Praxis advisor to the Martian president? You bet. So possibly she could make him do it. She heaved a big sigh, tried to feel less tight in her stomach. She could take the job and then turn most of the work over to Art and to whatever staff they gave her. She wouldn't be the first president to do that, nor the last. Praxis advisor to the Martian president, Art was announcing, looking pleased. Oh, shut up, she said. Of course. He left her alone to get used to it, came back with a steaming pot of kava and two little cups. He poured, she took one from him, and sipped the bitter fluid. He said, anyway, I'm yours, Nadia. You know that. Mm-hmm. She regarded him as he slurped his kava. He meant it more than politically, she knew. He was fond of her. All that time working together, living together, traveling together, sharing space. And she liked him. A bear of a man, graceful on his feet, full of high spirits. Fond of kava, as was obvious in his slurping, in his squinched face. He had carried the whole Congress, she felt, on the strength of those high spirits, spreading like an epidemic, the feeling that there was nothing so fun as writing a constitution. Absurd. But it had worked, and during the Congress they had become a kind of couple. Yes, she had to admit it. But she was now 159 years old. Another absurdity, but it was true. And Art was, she wasn't sure, somewhere in his 70s or 80s, although he looked 50, as they often did when they got the treatment early. I'm old enough to be your great-grandmother, she said. Art shrugged, embarrassed. He knew what she was talking about. I'm old enough to be that woman's great-grandfather, he said, pointing at a tall native girl passing by their office door, and she's old enough to have kids. So, you know, at some point it just doesn't matter. Maybe not to you. Well, yeah, but that's half of the opinions that count. Nadia said nothing. Look, Art said, we're going to live a long time. At some point the numbers have to stop mattering. I mean, I wasn't with you in the first years, but we've been together a long time now and gone through a lot. I know. Nadia looked down at the table, remembering some of those times. There was the stump of her long-lost finger. All that life was gone. Now she was president of Mars. Shit. Art slurped his kava, watched her sympathetically. He liked her. She liked him.
They were already a kind of couple.
"You help me with this damned council stuff," she said, feeling bleak as all her techno-fantasies slipped away.
"Oh, I will.
And then, well, we'll see."
"We'll see," he said, and smiled. So there she was, stuck on Pavonis Mons. The new government was assembling up there, moving from the warehouses into Sheffield proper, occupying the blocky, polished, stone-faced buildings abandoned by the Metanats. There was an argument, of course, over whether they were going to be compensated for these buildings and the rest of their infrastructure, or whether it had all been globalized or co-opted by independence and the new order.
"Compensate them," Nadia growled at Charlotte, glowering. But it didn't appear that the presidency of Mars was the kind of presidency that caused people to jump at her word. In any case, the government was moving in, Sheffield becoming, if not the capital, then at least the temporary seat of the global government. With Burroughs drowned and Sabashii burned, there was no other obvious place to put it, and in truth it didn't look to Nadia like any of the other tent towns wanted to have it. People spoke of building a new capital city, but that would take time, and meanwhile they had to meet somewhere. So around the peace to Sheffield they retired, inside its tent, under its dark sky. In the shadow of the elevator cable, rising from its eastern neighborhood straight and black, like a flaw in reality. Nadia found an apartment in the westernmost tent, behind the Rim Park, up on the fourth floor, where she had a fine view down into Pavonis's awesome caldera. Art took an apartment in the ground floor of the same building at the back. Apparently the caldera gave him vertigo. But there he was, and the Praxis office was in a nearby office building, a cube of polished jasper as big as a city block, lined with chrome-blue windows. Fine. She was there. Time to take a deep breath and do the work asked of her. It was like a bad dream in which the Constitutional Congress had suddenly been extended for 3 years. 3 M-years. She began with the intention of getting off the mountain occasionally and joining some construction project or other. Of course, she would perform her duties on the council, but working on an increase in greenhouse gas output, for instance, looked good, combining, as it did, technical problems and the politics of conforming to the new environmental regulatory regime. It would get her out into the backcountry, where a lot of the feedstocks for the greenhouse gases were located. From there, she could do her council business over the wrist. But events conspired to keep her in Sheffield. It was one thing after another, nothing particularly important or interesting compared to the Congress itself, but the details necessary to get things rolling. It was somewhat as Charlotte had said. After the design phase, the endless minutiae of construction. Detail after detail. She had to expect this. She had to be patient. She would work through the first rush and then get away. In the meantime, along with the startup process, the media wanted her, the new UN Martian office wanted her, very interested in the new immigration policies and procedures. The other council members wanted her. Where would the council meet? How often? What were its rules of operation? Nadia convinced the other 6 councillors to hire Charlotte to be council secretary and protocol chief, and after that, Charlotte hired a big crew of assistants from Dorsa Brevia. So they had the start of a staff. And Mikhail also had a great fund of practical experience in government from Bogdanov Vishniak. So there were people better suited than Nadia to do this work. But still she was called in a million times a day to confer, discuss, decide, appoint, adjudicate, arbitrate, administrate. It was endless. And then when Nadia did clear time for herself, forcibly, it turned out that being president made it very difficult to join any particular project. Everything going on was now part of a tent or a co-op. Very often they were commercial enterprises involved in transactions that were part non-profit public works,
part competitive market. So to have the president of Mars join any given co-op would be a sign of official patronage and couldn't be allowed if one wanted to be fair. It was a conflict of interest.
Shit,
she said to Art accusingly. He shrugged, tried to pretend he hadn't known. But there was no way out. She was a prisoner of power. She had to study the situation as if it were an engineering problem, like trying to exert force in some difficult medium. Say she wanted to build greenhouse gas factories. She was constrained from joining any factory co-op in particular. Therefore, she had to do it some other way. Emergence at a higher level. She could perhaps coordinate co-ops. There seemed to her good reasons to promote the building of greenhouse gas factories. The year without summer had extended to include a series of violent storms that had dropped off the Great Escarpment into the north, and most meteorologists agreed these Hadley cross-equatorial storms had been caused by the orbital mirror's removal and the resulting sudden drop in insolation. A full ice age was deemed a distinct possibility, and pumping up greenhouse gases seemed to be one of the best ways to counter it. So Nadia asked Charlotte to initiate a conference to come back with recommendations for forestalling an ice age. Charlotte contacted people in Da Vinci and Sabashii and elsewhere, and soon she had a conference scheduled to take place in Sabashii, named, by some Da Vinci saxoclone, no doubt, the Insolation Loss Effects Abatement Meeting, M53. Nadia, however, never made it to this conference. She got caught up by affairs in Sheffield instead, mostly instituting the new economic system which she thought important enough to keep her there. The legislature was passing the laws of eco-economics, fleshing out the bones drawn up in the Constitution. They directed co-ops that had existed before the revolution to help the newly independent Metanat local subsidiaries to transform themselves into similar cooperative organizations. This process, called horizontalization, had very wide support, especially from the young natives, and so it was proceeding fairly smoothly. Every Martian business now had to be owned by its employees only. No co-op could exceed 1,000 people. Larger enterprises had to be made of co-op associations working together. For their internal structures, most of the firms chose variants of the Bogdanovist models, which themselves were based on the cooperative Basque community of Mondragon, Spain. In these firms, all employees were co-owners, and they bought into their positions by paying the equivalent of about a year's wages to the firm's equity fund, wages earned in apprentice programs of various kinds at the end of schooling. This buy-in fee became the starter of their share in the firm, which grew every year they stayed until it was given back to them as pension or departure payment. Councils elected from the workforce hired management, usually from outside, and this management then had the power to make executive decisions, but was subject to a yearly review by the councils. Credit and capital were obtained from central cooperative banks or the Global Government Startup Fund or helper organizations such as Praxis and the Swiss. On the next level up, co-ops in the same industries or services were associating for larger projects and also sending representatives to industry guilds which established professional practice boards, arbitration and mediation centers, and trade associations. The Economic Commission was also establishing a Martian currency for internal use and for exchanges with Terran currencies. The Commission wanted a currency that was resistant to Terran speculation, but in the absence of a Martian stock market, the full force of Terran investment tended to fall on the currency itself as the only investment game being offered. This tended to inflate the value of the Martian sequin in Terran money markets, and in the old days it would probably have blown the sequin's value right through the roof to Mars's disadvantage in trade balances. But as the fracturing Metanats continued to struggle against cooperativization back on Earth, Terran finance remained in some disarray and didn't have its old house-on-fire intensity. So the sequin ended up strong on Earth, but not too strong,
and on Mars it was just money. Praxis was very helpful in this process, as they became a kind of federal bank for the new economy, providing interest-free loans and serving as a mediated exchange with Terran currencies. So given all this, the Executive Council was meeting for long hours every day to discuss legislation and other government programs. It was so time-consuming that Nadia almost forgot there was a conference she had initiated going on at the same time in Sabashii. On good nights, however, she spent a last hour or two on screen with friends in Sabashii, and it looked like things were going fairly well there, too. Many of Mars's environmental scientists were on hand, and they were in agreement that massively increasing greenhouse gas emissions would ease the effects of the mirror loss. Of course, CO2 was the easiest greenhouse gas to emit, but even without using it, as they were still trying to reduce it in the atmosphere to breathable levels, the consensus was that the more complex and powerful gases could be created and released in the quantities needed. And at first, they didn't think this would be a problem politically. The Constitution legislated an atmosphere no thicker than 350 millibars at the 6-kilometer contour, but said nothing about what gases could be used to create this pressure. If the halocarbons and other greenhouse gases in the Russell cocktail were pumped out until they formed 100 parts per million of the atmosphere, rather than the 27 parts per million that were currently up there, then heat retention would rise by several degrees Kelvin, they calculated, and an ice age would be forestalled, or at least greatly shortened. So the plan called for production and release of tons of carbon tetrafluoride, hexafluoroethane, sulfur hexafluoride, methane, nitrous oxide, and trace elements of other chemicals which helped to decrease the rate at which UV radiation destroyed these halocarbons.
This ends side one of cassette 9. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.